Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Jawanza. So great to be back with you. It's a beautiful day. I'm telling you, it's just beautiful just to be alive, first and foremost. So I'm just happy to be able to be here, to be able to share another powerful show with you on entrepreneurship. If you know and been following the show for a while, you know that every 2 weeks or so, we have a special guest that is our resident professor. He is an awesome author and a teacher, a professor, and he has written several books, two books, actually, and actually the books just keep growing and growing and growing. And again, if you're an entrepreneur, you know about Professor Geiger if you've been following the show. You know, you're going back and you're listening to the shows, you know that he has a wealth of knowledge, and we're very fortunate to have him come on and share biweekly with us his book and the principles in the book. Now, for all of you who tune into the shows and you listen to the principles, I would suggest that you actually get the book, okay? Because if you're an entrepreneur and you're out there, you're going to come across situations where you actually need the information that Professor Geiger shares, and you can't always pull up a show, you know, to get the information. So if you get the book and hone up on the principles, then you're going to make yourself put yourself in a much better position when these situations arise, and to have a guide, a compass to go back to actually say, you know, I read that, I read about this before, you know, let me go back to Professor's book and see what Professor Geiger has to say about this particular situation. And I might add that this book is not just about entrepreneurship. These principles are for life as well. Now, to all of the new listeners, I just want to say welcome, welcome, welcome. And if you're hearing Professor for the first time, let me tell you a little bit about Professor Geiger. Well, he's currently retired, but Professor Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. So before he even got his degree, he was already down the path that he would ultimately pursue. Well, after his second retirement, he actually taught entrepreneurship and small business management. And in order to help people like yourself and myself succeed in business, he's written this book, Entrepreneurial Success. It's actually up to 106 business principles, The Road to the Top. He's also author of the book, Finding a Career for Life, which we'll tell you a bit about in the show as the show progresses. But again, today we're going to be talking about entrepreneurship. We're going through the book, principle by principle, chapter by chapter. So before we get into the book, let me bring my guest on. Professor, great to have you back. You know, I'm going to have to call you earlier so we can continue our discussion we had before the show began. Great conversation. I'm always proud and happy to have you as my guest. Thank you so much for being my guest again today.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. Absolutely. You know, again, as I was mentioning to the listeners, we're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. Could you talk for a moment, Professor, before we actually get into the discussion today, just about mentors? You know, because this book actually serves as a mentor. I view you as a mentor. But I don't know if when you got into business, started your entrepreneurship career, I know when you started off as, you know, when your first business was when you were, you know, selling the trout flies. But after that and doing the papers on the college campus. But when you really got into business on a higher level, did you have a mentor? I mean, how important is that to have somebody, especially for those people who are new to starting a business, somebody that's been there, done that, and can actually serve as a guide to kind of steer people away from the landmines?
Well, I did. I think I would classify Mr. Ashby, who was I worked for and was a dear friend, as a mentor, but at the time I was not in business for myself. However, he certainly helped me. His name comes up in the book a number of times, but I really didn't. I wish I had, because I'm sure I would have avoided some pretty expensive mistakes that I made. I've been a mentor a couple of times in college, and for a few individuals I have. But when I was going through, I really wasn't. I had some people who mentioned one thing or another to me, but the way the word is used today as a mentor, I really did not have that, although it certainly would have been very, very helpful. Otherwise, you get to find out on your own, and you learn primarily by mistakes. And if you're in business, mistakes can be fairly costly. I really didn't. Of course, when I went through college, the word entrepreneurship, which is a French word and probably was known, it certainly was not common in the lexicon. I never remember seeing a class called entrepreneurship. And frankly, at the University of Denver, they didn't even have a class in small business management. At that time, if you went into business, the assumption was that you were going to go to work for a big company. And so I don't remember ever having a class other than maybe an accounting class where there was some. But short of that, I don't remember a class at all, certainly not in entrepreneurship. I never heard the word until I'd been out of college for many years.
Well, Professor, when it comes to somebody just going into business, they might have a talent, they may have a skill, they may feel like, okay, I'm a good chef, or I'm a good car mechanic. I can work on cars, and I know what I'm doing. I'm going to open up my own shop. Somebody can bake cakes, and I'm going to open up my own bakery. But there's a whole nother side to it. There's bookkeeping, there's accounting, there's, you know, all kinds of stuff. Would you suggest for somebody just going into business, if they have no skills, for example, outside of, the auto mechanic, let's say he's never been to business school, you know, he doesn't know about writing a business. Would you suggest, would it be your advice that, at least if you don't go to college to pursue a degree, you do at least need to go take a class, say, even if it's just a class on entrepreneurship or some sort of class that can familiarize you with certain things that you're going to have to know. For example, the cash flow forecast.
That's true. The problem is that even today, the vast majority of books on entrepreneurship, at least college books on entrepreneurship, textbooks, and college professors, the books are not written by somebody who has had much of any experience. As a matter of fact, I have used or reviewed 10 or 11 books, maybe there's 12 of them that I've gone through. And of those, only one was written by the author, in this case two authors, had actually started the business on their own. None of the others had ever done that. As a matter of fact, in most cases, none of the others had ever worked for a small business. One of the things that if you're going to get a book on it, you ought to at least get a bio. If you're going to go to a college class, find out what textbook they have and get a bio of who wrote it, biography of who wrote it. So where did they, what is their education background? I mean, presumably they went to grammar school and high school and then to college. But when they got out of college, if assuming they went to college, did they ever start a business? Did they ever even work for a business? In most cases, the answer is no. The same thing is true about the professor that teaches the entrepreneurship class. The recommendation I would give is to find out who's going to teach it, and then look up their bio. That's one of the glorious things of the internet. It's real simple to do. You can find bios on almost everybody. And certainly if they've published, it's pretty easy to do that. And the question I always have is, have they ever actually done it? So if you wanted to take piano lessons, for example, learn how to play the piano, would it be wise to find somebody who actually can play the piano? I mean, you
right.
wouldn't want to take lessons from me. I don't know how. I never have. And so I would be a very poor teacher, regardless of how good I am as a teacher, teaching piano or sculpture or painting or a variety of other things. I have absolutely no experience. And experience is most definitely the best teacher. There are some things that I think somebody who has no experience can teach. For example, it's pretty easy to teach history, or with a decent history book, it's pretty easy to teach math if you understand math, because the sciences and history are fixed. They you can teach those and not know very much about it if you're a good teacher and if you have a good book. But there are other things that you can't do that with. You can't do that with any of the arts. And frankly, I think entrepreneurship is a little bit of science, but a whole lot of art. And you should learn how to do things. And the difference between somebody who's successful and somebody who isn't is how well they can execute the art of what needs to be done. So that, to me, is just critical. And to take a class from somebody who has never done it, frankly, and particularly if the teacher has never done it, the odds are very high that the person writing the book has never done it. And so what are you going to learn? What do they really have to teach? What they teach is what the professor who wrote the book thought that entrepreneurship is all what it's all about. And that may or may not be true.
Or they can get your book.
That's right. They can get mine, and mine is different from others in that most books tell you what you should do in order to be successful. But what is really important if you're going to do it is how you should do it. Learning what you should do, you should write a business plan. Well, how do you do that? And if you don't know how to do it, knowing that you should do it, is interesting knowledge, but it's not terribly helpful, because what is helpful is learning how to do it. And that is true about hiring people. It's true about virtually everything with business. So how do you do it? And that is the reason that there's 106 business principles in my book, because what the principles do is show you how you should do the various things.
You know, just to stay on the business plan for a second, since you mentioned it, you know, and I think that is so important for young entrepreneurs to know that you got to do that. You know, that's something that you must do. And with the cash flow forecast, it's so important that you do that because, as Professor has mentioned on other shows, that, you know, you think about your business not just once every 6 months or once a year. You know, there are certain things that you're going to have to break down and categorize, some bi-weekly, some monthly, some quarterly. You know, you're going to have to think in a way that you might not be used to thinking. You're going to have to think about certain things that you just might not have had any experience or, you know, thinking about. Now that you are a business owner, you're going to have to focus in a certain way. You're going to have to spend time thinking about things and paying attention to details, very, very minute details that you otherwise, if you just had to work for somebody else, wouldn't concern you because, hey, it's not your bottom line. So,
that's right.
You know, it's very important to get, you know, to learn to process and to think in a certain way so that you can be successful in business. Because when you're on your own job, I mean, when you're working for somebody else, you know, you can spend time, you know, thinking about other things. But when it's your money that's either gained or lost, that's a whole other story, right, Professor?
That's absolutely true. And it is easy. Virtually all books say that you should write a business plan, although I have been at a couple of colleges where their idea of a adequate business plan, in my view, having done it 11 times, is totally inadequate. And I can think of, I'm not going to mention them on the radio, but there are just a lot of colleges who say, yeah, you should write a business plan, but as far as how you should do that, they don't really have a clue. And doing a cash flow forecast, there's some pretty high-powered colleges that are known nationally who don't even teach doing a cash flow forecast. I find it absolutely astonishing, but I know it's true because I've been there and I've been in some of their classes. I've been asked to come in as a guest speaker. And when I brought it up and asked the students, you got absolute blank stares. I mean, you might as well have been speaking Russian to them, because they had no understanding of what you were talking about. So, your reaction is, you got to be kidding me. But No, I'm not kidding you. That is very, very common, that they have no idea what a cash flow forecast is. And frankly, if you say you should do a business plan, in any kind of a detail that you need to have in order to actually do it, they don't have any of that detail. I mean, I've seen students from some of these colleges show me a one-page business plan. And wow. You say, my goodness, you really think you're going to find somebody who will lend you money or invest in your venture? Much less you doing it with your own money, based on this, you got to be kidding me. But They're not.
You know, the thing about business that's interesting is that people that are just starting out need to understand that even the other people that you're going to be dealing with in whatever field you're dealing in, whatever area you decide to start your business in, you're still going to be dealing with certain people. You're going to be dealing with possibly bankers, possibly attorneys, you know, people that are thinking in a totally business manner. And so you've got to learn the language of whatever your field is. You've got to learn the language. You've got to learn how to present yourself. And part of presenting yourself is having the business plan so that you can show whomever, if it's an investor, that you've actually thought out in the minutest detail what exactly it is that you want to do. You know, that this is not just some broad idea that you have, but you've actually thought it out. You've written it down. And, you know, you've got a plan. I mean, but you've got to be able to articulate your plan in a way that business people understand. You know, you're not just like you're talking to your buddy on the phone. You've got to talk like you're a professional. You know, you've got to sell your business.
Right.
You've got to make other people believe in your business. And you've got to come across as though you know what you're talking about. So you've got to speak and articulate yourself in a sometimes intellectual manner, a very professional manner, and you've got to, you know the language, correct, Professor?
Absolutely, but you should. A lot of people think that the purpose of the business plan is to show it to investors or to show it to bankers, financial people, and granted, that's one of the purposes of it. But the big purpose of it, I think, is to show it to yourself. Because if you do a proper business plan and a proper cash flow forecast, when you get through with that, I'll guarantee you that you'll have a totally different perspective on what your business, how it will play out in the next 2 to 3 years than you did when you started. At least that's been my experience, and I've done about six of them. The first few businesses I started, I didn't have one, and I most certainly wished I did because, with few exceptions, it certainly cost me a lot of money because I didn't have a business plan. I had to find out the hard way. I had to have surprises, and most surprises in business eventually get to be financial surprises, and the vast majority are bad. When it's your own money, well, it's it tends to get your attention.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's who it's really for, a business plan. And I've told my classes this forever, that a business plan is for you, the entrepreneur. You're the number one user of the business plan. Bankers and investors are also users. They're on the list. But if you had a 1 to 10, the bottom 7 are for you, and maybe the top 3 are for investors and bankers.
Well, everybody, now that was just an aside, okay? So we want you to know that the book is full of information. What you just heard was just an aside on the business plan, but we have a whole chapter dedicated to the business plan, or shall I say, Professor has dedicated a whole chapter to the business plan. So you definitely want to get the business plan, and you definitely want to know how to do it, and you get that information in this book. Now, again, we're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle, and if you're just tuning in for the first time, we are on chapter 8 in the book, Growing a Business, and we're up to principle number 79, which is compare the possibilities. Compare the possibilities. Now, we're talking about, keep this in the context, everybody, of growing a business. That's the context, okay? Compare the possibilities. Professor?
Well, this is a tool that you use to compare things, and we all do it all the time. In other words, if we have a problem, and frankly, the only difference between problems that you have as an individual and problems that you'll run into in a business, there's a couple of differences. The big difference is the business problems, there are more of them. They come at you faster. They play out at a much higher speed. They are far more complex, and they cost a lot more money. And those are the big differences. They are essentially the same as the problems you have as an individual. But like I say, there are more of them. They come at you faster. They cost more money. They're far more complex because there's more people involved. There's more items involved. Usually there's more money involved. So using compare the possibilities is just one of many tools that you use, and we do it all the time in our own daily life, and you certainly do it in business. It's primarily for the smaller challenges that you have in business. And there's a couple of things when people say the possibilities, usually how many times, just think back in your own that you've heard people say, I think I have two choices, and both of them aren't really very good ones. Which one should I choose? And my reaction to that is, if that's your case, before you even tell me what they are, probably you shouldn't choose either one of them. You should probably try to continue doing what you're doing now, because at least now you know whether or not there's any unintended consequences. If there are, what they are, and you have worked out ways of dealing with those unintended consequences. When you make a new choice, one of the questions you ask yourself is, are there any unintended consequences? And if there are, they're going to be new, and you will probably find out about them as the situation plays out. So there's a couple of things that one should look at when you're looking at the possibilities, comparing the possibilities. One of them is the fantasy of the false premise. And so what is a basic premise that you're dealing with? And the other one is the false alternative. And very often there is, you know, more than one alternative. Quite frankly, I think there's always three alternatives. You can do nothing, which is what you're doing now. You may be doing something now, but you can continue to do now. Or you can do one of the alternatives that you've come up with. So there's always going to be two or three, and one of them should always be to do nothing. In other words, to continue to do what you're doing now. Unless you have a worthwhile alternative that moves you ahead, and that you're fairly sure if there are unintended consequences, you know what they are, and you have a system to deal with them. Unless you have that, then perhaps you ought not to do anything. And because when people start doing stuff, there are usually repercussions, and in business, often they're bad and they're costly. And just remember, it's your money that you're dealing with. It is you who have signed guarantees for borrowed money, and so they'll come back. That will come back to bite you. So be really, really careful about what are the alternatives. And the last thing I would suggest to you is, it seems simple, but I would suggest you ought to write them down. People very often do not write them down, and I think that's a mistake. What I've found is, when I had a problem and I wanted to compare the alternatives, when I first thought about it, I thought, well, there's two or three alternatives. But if I wrote them down and put my little list in my book, or in my desk, and I have the positive and the negatives, and then come back at it an hour later or a day later, I find I have more. And very often, the more you will find the right one for you. But for goodness sakes, always write them down.
So if someone, we've all heard the phrase, choosing the lesser of two evils. If somebody is faced with a situation like that, your suggestion would be, just wait until a better alternative comes along, because if your choices are two evils, then you're in a better position to just wait on something better.
Yeah, that would be my strong suggestion is if you have the lesser of two evils, then maybe you ought to wait until you find something that doesn't have an evil in it. Because if it has an evil in it that you see now, the odds are pretty good that there's another one hiding in the weeds. And that one's going to jump out and bite you shortly after you start down the new path. So if it's the lesser of two evils, maybe doing what you're doing now is even less evil. At least doing what you're doing now, you know what the evil is. And when you start down a new path, the truth is you really don't know what the evil is.
And you know at least the outcome. At least when you say if you're going to choose between the lesser of two evils, you know that the outcome of that choice is going to be evil.
Yeah.
You're choosing between two evils. So
that's absolutely true. And the two evils, each of those evils, probably have other things buried in them that you don't know about yet. But once you get in it, then you will. So it is the evil that seems to be the lesser, there may be something hidden in there that would turn it into the greater. and and you'd just be better off. I just find that whenever I have done that, I ended up wishing I hadn't. That looking back at it, it was very common that whatever I was doing to start with was a hell of a lot better than picking the one that I picked, which I thought would be an improvement. But in fact, it turned out not to be an improvement.
Well, Professor, if we could stay here for a second just to go deeper into the fallacy of the false premise, because that I think a lot of people get jammed up in that. You know, the premise of a particular thing is wrong. And so, for example, if somebody can even have you arguing a position on the wrong premise, then your whole argument is off because the premise is false, and now they've got you. Because now they've got you playing in their ballpark because you're not even arguing a factual premise.
That's true. Let me give you a kind of a funny one. When I was in business in California and I decided to move to Virginia, I told people about that, and it was very common for somebody in California to say, "What do you want to do that for? The weather's terrible. It's cold and damp. It's snowy in the winter and rains all the time. In the summer, it's hot and dry. What do you want to do that for?" But, there is a plus, and that is there aren't any earthquakes, which they were in California. And that's true, except when there are. And if you don't believe me, ask some of the people up in Louisa County in about 2007, what a 5.8 earthquake is all about. So that was a false premise to say, well, I want to move in order to get away from earthquakes. Well, where are you moving? You're moving where there are mountains. The only difference is the mountains in the Allegheny Mountains are not anywhere near as big and as new as the ones in the Sierra Nevada. But they're still mountains. And if you look at them, they're black faulted mountains. How did that happen? Well, it happened with earthquakes. That's how it happened.
And it's
been happening for millions of years. It's just the new mountains in California are just newer, and so there's more earthquakes. But in the geological scheme of things, the ones that caused the Alleghenies were pretty big earthquakes at one time. Now they're not so much anymore, but they're still happening. So that was very much a false premise. So make sure that whatever your premise is, that it's not a false premise. Because if it is, or any of the assumptions are not true, well, then the whole darn thing crumbles. So make sure that that's not the case.
Okay, everybody, we're moving through the book principle by principle, and now we're on to principle number 80, which is when all else fails, try grim determination. When all else fails, when you've tried everything else and nothing else works, try grim determination. Professor, I know you got something to share.
Yeah, that anybody who's been in business very long, a lot of people think that somebody who's been in business for a while and they're pretty successful, boy, it just all happened. And they didn't have the tough times that you're having. Well, that's just not true. When I got around to selling businesses and they were up and running and doing really well, I looked back and, boy, there were some toughy times. But people who looked at it from the outside never saw those. You should just remember that you're going to have some tough times, and not giving up is really important. There's kind of a funny story out there about Mother Teresa, who is now Saint Teresa. But Mother Teresa, anybody who knows about her, she worked, she was a European. She went to India as a young woman and joined the Catholic Church, and and started to help people. And she had a tough life, and the people that she was helping were even tougher. And there's a really funny story. When she became successful and was always out trying to raise money for her many causes, there's a story about her going to a guy by the name of William, why am I just drawing a blank here? Anyway, he was an attorney, and a very powerful attorney in New York, or in Washington, D.C., and she went to him to try to, Everett Bennett Williams was his name. And
okay.
She went to see Mr. Williams to try to get some money. And Mr. Williams decided he didn't want to, he had a pretty good idea of that she was going to ask him for money and for what it was going to be for. And he decided before she showed up that he really wasn't going to lend or give, wasn't lend, it was a gift. And he wasn't going to do that. But he didn't want to turn Mother Teresa down. I mean, you know, she was a pretty famous person. And so she didn't want, didn't want to do that. So at any rate, Mother Teresa shows up at his office, and she is chauffeured into a big meeting room. And Mother Teresa was a tiny person. I don't think she was 5 feet tall. And she could just barely see over this big table. And pretty soon she was taken in there, and then pretty soon Mr. Williamson showed up. And Mother Teresa got right to her point. She didn't want to battle around at all. She just went right at it, and she made her pitch for some money, a gift from Mr. Williams. And so he told her that he thought it was a good cause, but at that time he didn't want to contribute. And she immediately said, "Well, let us pray upon the matter." And so she said a little prayer, and the moment she was finished with the prayer, she launched right back into a request for money. And when she got through, he said, "Well, it was a good cause," and he wished her a lot of luck, but he didn't want to contribute at this time. And she said, "Well, let's pray upon the matter a moment." And she went into her prayer. And as soon as she finished the prayer, but before she could launch again into offering, trying to get him to give some money, he took out his checkbook and made a very generous donation. She did not give up. She said, he said to her in the book where this story is recounted, that you are a very determined woman. And quite frankly, anybody who knew the history of Mother Teresa and her life story knew that being determined, the grim determination, was an absolute requirement for her life's work, because that's what it took. And in business, you will find that there are lots and lots of opportunities that you'll have when you think, "I just can't do this anymore. It's not going to work." And my recommendation is try grim determination. I can remember calling up somebody I knew when I was in the airplane business and hit a pretty rough period, and calling this guy up and telling him my tale of woe. And he said, "Well, that sounds about right, but you need to kind of stay at it and it'll work out." And sure enough, I stayed at it, and sure enough, it did work out.
You know, Professor, I remember reading a story in, I forget what book it was. It might have been The Science of Getting Rich or Think and Grow Rich, one of those books. But there was a story about a guy, a gold digger, who had gone out, you know, when the when everybody was going out west, I guess, to, you know, find gold or whatever, and he went out and bought all this equipment, and, you know, went out and, you know, started digging and digging and digging and digging and digging and digging and digging, and just kept digging and digging and digging and digging and digging, but never struck gold, or it was oil, maybe it was oil. and became very, very disheartened. And at some point, ultimately, long story short, he sold all of his equipment. You know, he, you know, gave it up, you know, just said, you know, I wasted a lot of money. I just, he threw in the towel or whatever. But then there was somebody who had been watching him for a long time out there digging and, you know, without any success. And this individual decided, you know, I think there's oil. That's what it was. It was oil. I think there's oil in that well that he had already started. And ultimately, long story short, he went out, and all he had to do was dig 3 feet further than the guy had already, and then struck oil. And the motto of that was, don't quit 3 feet before the oil, or 3 feet before the gold, or whatever it was.
Right,
You know, you never know. You just, you know, that extra.
You don't know, and you don't know when somebody will come up with a slight change. There's a lot of talk about the good and the evils of fracking, and to listen to the people who talk about the evils of fracking, what they don't understand is fracking has been around for a long, long time. As a matter of fact, other than a few high-pressure wells that turned into gushers, the vast majority of them required fracking. And what they did is they drilled down until they hit shale or rock that it was oil-bearing, and then they set off a dynamite charge right in that rock. They knew how far down it was, so they lowered some dynamite down to maybe, let's say it was 8,430 feet. So they lowered 8,435 feet down, and wham, they set it off. Sometimes it lit the thing and it blew and it had a fire. Other times it didn't. And the fracking that now takes place, what happened is somebody figured out how to drill horizontally. In other words, let's say that you knew that there was oil-bearing rock at 10,000 feet down, and there was 100 feet of oil-bearing rock. Above it, there was no oil, and below it, they didn't find oil, but at 100 feet, they found, or at 10,000 feet, they found 100-foot thick oil-bearing rock. What they normally, they used to do years and years ago was set off a charge right there and crack the rock and get the oil to ooze out of the rock. But if you think about it, what they're doing is they could only hit the rock with dynamite in that 100 feet where the drill went through. So it was 100 feet. With horizontal drilling, they knew where it was, so they could drill down 10,000 feet. And just before they got there, they learned how to turn the direction of the drill. So it went right through the 100 feet thick, and they'd go out for a mile, 5,000 feet. All of that mile was in the oil-bearing rock. That was the horizontal drilling. And they combined that with fracking. And fracking now, instead of being dynamite, is done hydraulically. So they fill it with a certain type of liquid, and then they hit it with a big jolt, and that cracks the rock. And so they get oil out of that 100 feet, maybe for 200 feet wide on either side of the drill, but for a mile, 5,000 feet and 200 feet wide. And all of a sudden, they got tremendous oil and gas. And that's what's made America the biggest producer of gas and oil in the world. We beat Russia, we beat Saudi Arabia, and because we know how to do horizontal drilling and frack it. So we get it used to be that if you could get 10% of the oil in the rock out, you did fair. If you got 20%, you did as good as you're ever going to get. Today, they're talking about 80%. All because they learned how to do something new. And if you knew where that oil was, maybe when you drilled down and you had this one little hole going right straight through it, there wasn't enough to really make it pay. But if you could get the oil out of that same little 100-foot thick layer for a mile and 400 feet wide, wow, now you have lots and lots of oil.
So you're going to make me go out there and start digging in the backyard, man, see if I can, I can come up with something, man. See what
well, there's mm-hmm. one little oil field in Pennsylvania and New York State. They won't let them drill in New York State. It's called the Marcellus. And the Marcellus gas field is what's dropped gas prices in the United States, natural gas prices, to about 10% of what it was 20 years ago from one field, the Marcellus. They knew it was there, but they mm-hmm. couldn't get the darn gas out. Once they learned how to horizontally drill, wham. Now there is more gas. There's so much gas from that one field that it's made America the biggest producer of natural gas in the world. That one field.
That is amazing.
Yeah,
one field.
That's
amazing.
And actually, it's half of one field because half of it's in Pennsylvania and the other half is in New York. They won't let them drill in New York. The state will not let them drill in New York. But half of the Marcellus field has turned America into the largest producer of natural gas in the world.
Hmm. Everybody, when you tune into Entrepreneurial Success, you get so much more than information about entrepreneurship. I mean, you just learned something today, and that was just from one of the principles. We started talking about one of the principles, and you see where it led us. We had a lesson today. Professor, thank you for that. Again, a lot of times, that was just, you know, basically from grim determination. You know, when all else
yep.
fails, try grim determination. Again, everybody, we're going through the book principle by principle. I don't know if we have time for one more, Professor. Retail people run retail companies, and railroad people run railroads. You have time for that?
Yeah, that doesn't take very long. When you hear somebody, let's say that you have a small restaurant. And you have two mentors, and you're trying to decide who's your better mentor. And one of the mentors ran restaurants and food service of one kind or another. And the other one was the vice president in charge of finance for General Motors. Who should you pick? The guy who had a couple of little restaurants, or the guy who was finance for General Motors? It's really easy. It's the guy who had the restaurants. He has experience. Sun Tzu said that experience is the best teacher, but it's experience in what you're needing and what you're doing that is the best teacher. Just because somebody is in big business doesn't mean that they know anything about your little business. I had the food service at Coleman Company in Wichita, Kansas, many years ago. And the Coleman Company decided that they needed some really, they were really taken off. They went from making lanterns, and all of a sudden they got into outdoors equipment. And they figured that they needed some real big help. So Sheldon Coleman, who was the grandson of the person who founded the Coleman Company, hired a guy from General Motors who was really, really high-powered salesperson at General Motors. In 6 months, that guy just about bankrupted Coleman.
Wow.
He had worked for General Motors. And when they wanted to do something, he did it big. And if he needed $10 million, he could go to the finance department of General Motors, and hell, $10 million, let's start talking about serious money here, but that's hardly worth the accounting. Well, for Coleman Company, $10 million was a lot of money. And so what happened is Sheldon hired somebody who was a real high-powered guy, but not for a smallish company, and certainly not in the manufacturing of tents and Coleman stoves and camping equipment and all that sort of thing. He didn't know sic'em about it. He knew about cars. He knew about railroad trains because he had made those things. But as far as tents and outdoor equipment, he didn't know anything about it. He certainly also didn't know what it was like to run a company where $10 million was a whole lot of money. He'd mm-hmm. been in a company where $10 million was a rounding error. And yeah, it really was. I mean, you know, at that time, General Motors had over 300,000 employees.
Mm-hmm.
And Coleman had maybe 600-700. So, and it was a whole different ball of wax. Coleman had lots of people who had been with them for 50 years. If you'd worked for Coleman for 30 years, you and hundreds of other people had worked for them for 30 years. When you went to work for Coleman, that you were there for life. And very often, your children and your grandchildren also worked for Coleman. It's just the way it was there. I mean, they were very protective of Coleman, the workers. Now, I'm talking about manufacturers. I'm talking about people who ran lathes and punch presses and milling machines and all that sort of thing, who worked with their hands. They were very, very protective of Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
With General Motors, he didn't have that experience. His experience with labor was with the CIO who were trying to shut him down all the time. And that just didn't happen with Coleman. I mean, I'm sure that the big labor unions that showed up to try to unionize Coleman, and knowing Sheldon, and I knew him fairly well, I'm sure he told them, yeah, go out and talk to my people. But Sheldon knew full well there is no way that a labor union was going to make any kind of dent in Coleman. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And he did. He just took care of his people. I mean, he was the kind of guy that if you came in and one of your children was hurt and needed some medical, and this was before medicine like we have now. This was back in when people paid for the medicine they had. You could go, any of his workers could go to Coleman, and he'd write him a check from his own account. You know, you need $1,000 to pay for an orthopedic surgeon? Here it is. Boom, done. When should I pay you back, Mr. Coleman? Whenever you have the money, pay me back.
Wow. That's
yeah.
You don't find them like that no more.
Nope. And, of course, the upside of that is within 2 days, everybody in the whole plant knew that Sheldon Coleman had given one of their workers the money it took to take care of a sick child and did not ask for it to come back. If you want to pay me back, fine. This is for you to help your family.
Wow.
That's why they were there for so long. I mean, there were people who the grandfather had been there for 50 years. The son had been there for 30 years. The grandson had been there for 10 years. And they have a little baby who probably would grow up and also work for Coleman. I mean, it's just incredible.
So we'll have to talk about that on another, and maybe the next time we have you on, Professor, just the culture of companies, you know, the culture there, because you it sounds like Coleman created a culture there you know, had people want to stay there, want to work there, and you know, they saw that he was a good guy, and when you work for somebody and you like the person that you're working for, that helps. That certainly helps, as opposed to
You got to remember, at Wichita, Boeing Aircraft was there. And for machinists, Boeing would pay 50% more. But when the job was done, they'd hire 1,000 people to do something. And when that contract was finished, they'd fire the 1,000. So they might pay him 50% more, even twice as much. But with Coleman, that wasn't ever going to happen. I think Sheldon Coleman would bankrupt himself helping out his people if something happened to his company that he had to fire somebody. He might lay him off, but he'd take care of him somehow.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we'll definitely have to do a show on the culture, just the culture of companies, because that is such a very, very important piece to this, to entrepreneurship. And if you are starting a business, you want to make sure that the culture that you create at your business is such that, like a Coleman, you know, people want to work for you. They come and work for you, and they can buy into your vision, and they stay. They stay to help you fulfill what it is that you're
trying
to do. So, Professor, let's tell them how they can get your book. It's awesome. Again, everybody, if you're serious about becoming an entrepreneur, or even if you are already an entrepreneur, there's always something that you can learn. Never think that you know it all. There's 106. If you don't have this book, then there are 106 principles that you don't have, okay? So definitely get the book, okay? Get the cash flow forecast while you're at it. And, you know, let's lay a foundation so that when you go out there and you jump out into the world of entrepreneurship, you are ready. So when you pull that string, the parachute opens. Okay. Professor, how can they get your book?
Well, they can get it at Amazon. And when you do, you go to Amazon Books and type in Entrepreneurial Success 106 Principles. Make sure you put the 106 principles. When I first wrote the first book, I was the only entrepreneurial success out there. But now there's a whole bunch of others. And if you just type in entrepreneurial success, you're going to have to go through a whole bunch of them. But if you add to it 106 principles, you'll go right to me. And my own website, theroadtothetop.com, we're redoing it, so right now it's down, and if you look for that, it isn't there right now, but it will be shortly. But so you can always go to Amazon and get the book there.
Professor, I told the listeners in the beginning that we would just tell them about your other book, Finding a Career for Life. Everybody, you've to get this book, okay, because you definitely know somebody, it's not you personally, you know somebody that's going to be able to benefit from the information in this book. It's called Finding a Career for Life. Can you tell them about that book, Professor?
Yeah, it's it's what it sounds like. For me, it's a pain in the rear with entrepreneurial success. I write the book and then keep printing it for years, and every so often I'll add to it. But with Finding a Career for Life, I've got to redo it every year. And so the current edition is 2019. Then next year there will be 2020. And because I try to keep it very current. The book has no agenda. I don't care whether you want to get a PhD in whatever or not. I do not care whether I don't recommend that you go to college. What I do is say that if you're not going to go to college and you have a high school education, the following are the top 20 or so businesses or top 20 or so careers that you should take, and where I got the information. And just because you don't have a college education, there's quite a number of careers that pay pretty well. For example, there is no college requirement to become an airline pilot. You have to have 3 flying licenses, private, a commercial, and what's called an ATP. But if you have those 3 today, and you just got the last ones, the ATP, Airline Pilots or Commercial Traffic Association, or airline traffic. And if you got that today, you could get a job at a whole bunch of regional airlines. You're going to get offered $60,000 to $90,000 a year. And in 4 years or 5 years, you will have enough time to get a job with one of the majors, American Airlines, Pan Am, Delta, or whatever, you know. And that starts at $150,000, and by mid-career, you should be pushing $300,000 a year. So it's very lucrative, and you do not need a college education for that. Now, there's all kinds of jobs that you do need a college education. If you want to be an orthopedic surgeon, you do. If you want to be a petroleum engineer, you do. Probably if you want to be a psychologist, you do. And it all depends. The cost to get a bachelor's degree is going to be pretty much the same at whatever college. So if you go to Rice University in Houston, Texas, and you get a degree in petroleum engineering, it'll probably cost you $60,000-$70,000. If you get a degree in psychology, it'll probably cost you $60,000-$70,000. With a psychology degree, you can expect to make $40,000 eventually, and with the petroleum engineer, you should make $180,000. Cost the same, cost 4 years of your time, same amount of dollars, but one pays probably 4 or 5 times as much. And I tell you about that. I also tell you whether the people in the jobs like the jobs. And you'll be very surprised, at least I certainly was very surprised, at which careers people really liked, they were proud of. And some I thought they would be, they weren't. And others that I thought they would be, they were. But all that data is in this little book. It costs less than $10.
And you know, one of Professor Geiger's principles in this book, the other book, the one we talked about today, Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, is all decisions should be data-driven. So
yep.
When you are thinking about a career, and especially young people who are, you know, at that age, of, let's say, for example, you take a junior in high school that doesn't know what they plan on doing when they get out of school, you know, and, you know, for something, college isn't for everybody. I mean, for some people,
yeah.
You know, that's just not the route that they're going to go. Some people are, you know, they just have an entrepreneurial bend, and, you know, that's what they're going to do. You know, everybody's not going to go to college. But if you do decide to go, you definitely need to know that just because you can draw doesn't mean that you should pursue a career in art if you want to, you know, make a substantial living, a substantial amount of money. You know, just because you can sing doesn't necessarily mean that you should, you know, go to college for music, to get a music degree or something. But
right.
The choice is always yours, but just make sure your choices are data-driven. Professor, thank you, thank you, thank you. I really appreciate you coming back on again. Great show. Always powerful, powerful information. Any closing words for our listeners today?
No, just buy the books. looking forward to when I'm back in a couple of weeks.
If not sooner.
Okay.
We'll be talking soon. Thank you so much, Professor.
Right.
Again, great show, as always. Talk
great
to you soon.
Great show. Thank you much. Bye-bye.
Everybody, that's Professor Joseph Geiger, author of the book Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Also, author of Finding a Career for Life. If you're serious about being an entrepreneur, get your information from somebody who's done it. You know, a lot of times we get information from people who mean well, but they just might not be the person that we need to ask. You know, we just might be asking the wrong person. So Professor Geiger has taught entrepreneurship and small business management at the collegiate level, okay, at institutions of higher learning. So on top of that, he's done it, all right? So when you put that combination together, you're bound to come out on top, okay? So definitely get the book. I mean, one principle can save you. It's worth more than the price of the book itself. So definitely get the book and share it with somebody that you know. We got the holidays coming up. I mean, hey, if you know a young person that's really, you know, undecided about what they want to do with their future, you know, they say information is power, but it's not powerful if it's not in your hands, if you don't read it, right? So get the information, share the books with the people that you know and love, and trust me, they'll benefit from it. My name is Jawanza. I thank you so much for tuning in. You could be doing anything, but you decided to spend it with my person and Professor Joseph Geiger. Again, he comes on bi-weekly, so he'll be back within 2 weeks, in 2 weeks, if not sooner. So, again, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate you. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.